Today on Maine Calling, the race for the White House. The Democratic National Convention wraps up tonight with a keynote address from the party's nominee for the White House, Vice President Kamala Harris. As newly energized Democrats anticipate her speech, former President Trump is attacking Harris on immigration and the economy. Meanwhile, most polls show a shift in Kamala Harris's favor in the swing states so important in the presidential race. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we check in with politics experts Ron Schmidt and Gene Cummings for their analyses of the race at this point. How accurate are the polls? Will Democrats maintain their momentum, or will it fizzle after the convention? How much will fake viral social media videos affect the race? What might we see happen this fall? Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling is made possible by support from Maine Farmland Trust, working this summer to purchase and protect the historic Morris Farm in Wiscasset. Learn more at mainefarmlandtrust.org. By Welch and Forbes, working with clients to manage the full range of events that come with building wealth, from investments to trustee services. More at welchforbes.com. And by Maine Seacoast Mission, supporting Maine island communities through education, health, and community engagement. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. The Democratic National Convention wraps up this evening with an acceptance speech from Vice President Kamala Harris. Today, we will speak with our political experts about how the race has changed since President Biden decided not to run for re-election. Joining me to share their perspective on the race and what to look for going forward, Ron Schmidt, professor of political science and department head at the University of Southern Maine, Gene Cummings, former deputy chief at the Wall Street Journal's Washington Bureau. We invite you to join the conversation. What matters most to you this election cycle? Have you been watching the conventions? And if so, what has stood out to you? Send us a brief email, talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Welcome back to both of you. Thank you very much for being here. Gene, I'll start with you, and I'm going to ask both of you the same broad question to start. As you watch the Democratic National Convention, what stands out to you?
Well, I think the party was so divided just a month ago. It's amazing to me how they've kind of all coalesced around Kamala Harris and Tim Walz as their nominees. It seems like Biden did a great job on Monday of graciously passing the baton to his vice president. But we know from behind the scenes that many in the Biden camp were still bitter about the way he was pressed to step aside. There's just no sign of it publicly at this event. And that bodes very well for them, because that was her first task, is reunite the party behind her candidacy.
Ron, what about to you? What has stood out as you've watched the convention?
I mean, I agree with Gene. There's a there's often this theme with capital D Democratic politics of the Democrats in disarray, of discord and fights among the many, many groups that make up the party. And this convention so far is going very smoothly, especially when you consider the sudden transformations in the campaign just within the last month. So that's been kind of a surprise and impressive, I think. And then the party conventions in this period of our history are really less about choosing a candidate than they are about reminding voters, both within the party and outside of the party, what the party is about, clarifying its mission, its message, its vision for the election going forward. And I think they've done a good job with that. This was something that has always caused President Biden some difficulty, is explaining what it means to situate yourself as not just the pro-Democratic Party candidate, but as the pro-democracy candidate. And as messy as democracy is, I think the convention so far has managed to communicate that to people without getting too lost in the mess.
Well, Ron, this leads into one of my big questions here. Do conventions matter? And if so, in what way?
They do still matter. They matter because they give the party a chance to make some concrete promises, which is an important part of the way that we do representation. You know, people say they'll attempt to do X, Y, and Z if they're elected, and then that's a way that voters can try to hold them accountable. And I think the Democrats have done a fairly good job this time at clarifying what they're about. And it also introduces the party as a group of people and the leading candidates to voters. There's a certain amount of bias watching these things as a political scientist, because I can actually watch, 10 hours of this and will watch that much time in an evening. And the vast majority of people, of course, are much too psychologically healthy to spend their evenings doing that.
Well, I was,
And
yeah, that's so funny. I was going to ask Gene, do we know how many people actually watch and who they are? Are they swing voters or are they hardcore partisans with whichever party?
So a lot of people are watching clips, and I think that they've done a pretty good job of providing informative moments with various candidates and various issues.
Gene?
Well, we haven't seen really strong data about who's watching. What is striking is that they are going to great lengths to reach out beyond their Democratic base. They needed to make it whole. They did that remarkably quickly. But what has struck me are the number of Republicans and former Trump aides who have taken to the stage. This is unprecedented to see, a former press secretary basically say, don't put him back in the White House, and I'm going to vote for the Democrat. And, the Georgia lieutenant governor saying, if you vote for a Democrat, it doesn't make you a Democrat, it makes you an American citizen. You're standing up for your country. It makes you a patriot. Those are really unusual messages coming from the convention stage. I don't know if they're reaching anyone. I saw an interview with on CNN with the former press secretary. She said, her email filled with good and bad. And her hope is, if she could just open the mind of some independents, then she felt like she would have done her job. So enough people saw that or are aware of that to, fill up her inbox. But we don't have good data yet on how much is really being watched. And I have to admit, Monday night, I felt, kind of went off the rails to have Biden delivering his speech. Basically, at around midnight is great if you live in California, but it really stinks if you're on the East Coast. That's a lot of viewership that I am sure they lost. And Biden gave a powerful speech, but I don't know how many people were able to go the distance to watch it. And it was pretty impressive that a president who was deemed too old to run for re-election managed to stay up until midnight and give a forceful, energetic speech.
Gene, nearly every poll now shows a significant shift in Kamala Harris's favor. Do you believe the polls are accurate? And if they are accurate, is this a bump because of the convention or something more?
Yeah, I'm generally pretty skeptical of polls this far out, but I think there's an energy that is palpable. That things have changed. And, Trump is certainly acting like things have changed too. So I think both sides understand that. I do think that what is probably the bigger benefit to her, as Ron said, conventions matter because they also energize your base. And, I remember like George W. Bush had on the last day of the convention, buses outside of the convention center, and attendees walked out of the center right onto the buses to go door knocking. It's, getting that kind of energy going is very important because it will be a close election. And, each side is going to be striving to get every single vote out that they can.
All right, Ron, what's your thought about polls at this point?
Gene's right. It's too early for us to get a whole lot from the polls in terms of certainty. And the numbers we're seeing are close. But so I think it's most telling to see how people are reacting to that. And Donald Trump does seem to be suffering from a lot of anxiety about the new data. And that's having an effect, I think, on his events and the tone that he's striking. And it's also definitely having an effect on I think the Democratic base. I think this is why we've seen a lot of people this week on stage stressing that this is going to be close and that things aren't over, and reminding people that they're going to need to fight if they hope to win, reminding them that they have to go door knocking and so on, because you don't want to give your base too much the impression that you're winning clearly, because they might tune out, or they might not put in the effort that you need to win.
Ron, the Harris campaign now says that Arizona, Georgia, Nevada, and North Carolina are in play, some even suggesting Texas. Do you agree that states that didn't seem to be in play are now in play?
I think that this opens up certainly at least the possibility that, I don't know about Texas, but this certainly opens up the possibility that there's a lot more territory for the Democrats to expand in than there were before. There's still issues, particularly in those areas, that the Democrats have to deal with. They've got to deal with the energy of the Latino electorate. They've got to deal with the gender gap among Latinos. And they're going to be trying, I think probably we'll see some of that tonight, to create a new narrative around issues at the border, for both their base and for voters outside. But I think that we're seeing a campaign that's going to be looking to play in a much broader variety of locations than maybe would have been the case 2 months ago.
Gene.
I think they were already in play. I mean, those states were going to be close. It's going to be tiny margins, and they will decide who becomes president. It is interesting, though, that Kamala Harris may have an opportunity to really carve out that sort of southwest path to getting the electoral college votes she needs. If the Democrats could ever do that in a really comfortable way, then it takes all the pressure off of holding the blue wall. She can get there by a different road. North Carolina was in play the last time, the last election. It was, decided by a tiny margin. And so was the case Arizona, Nevada. I think that's been the case and it's going to stay the case. I agree with Ron. Texas is a Democratic dream, but I don't see that dream coming to reality in this cycle.
I want to ask you about something that's pretty new to this election cycle. We saw little bits of it before, but really, I have seen so many AI-generated photos and videos. Some are clearly fake, some are downright funny, but others are crafted to seem very real. Gene, how much of an impact will these altered photos and videos have in this race?
Well, we'll see. Let's face it, dirty tricks start popping up in August, but they become far more intense as we get closer to election day. And we already know there are some foreign characters who are trying to influence the election. If you have a really, really close election, it's hard to pin down what might have made the difference. And these could. What I think is important is that both campaigns, and I think they are, stand ready for them and fight back. I covered years ago when John Kerry's record in Vietnam was attacked, and they just couldn't believe anyone would believe the attacks. And so they didn't react really well. And I think the body politic as a whole learned from that lesson. You have to fight back, and you have to call out those that are fake, but they may not find them all, depending on how much is generated.
Sure. I mean, it seems as though there's already a tsunami of them. Ron, what's your thought on what their impact will be this time around?
Yeah, Gene's right. We don't know entirely yet how big an impact it's going to have. But the fact is, with a race like this one, the impact doesn't have to be that huge for it to still be decisive. I think that this is an issue I come back to again and again as an academic, is that we need to do a much better job, I think, of educating the citizenry about fakes, about how to detect these things, about how to read ads, and about how to deal with the possibility of them becoming a big part of the discussion in the media, and how to sort of bring a certain amount of suspicion, but not cynicism, to the way that we engage the process as citizens.
What about the vice presidential candidates? How much, Gene, how much does it matter? How much do Tim Walz and JD Vance matter in this race?
I'm a little contrarian on this because I think that a vice presidential candidate matters a lot when they hurt. It doesn't matter otherwise, but if and I think JD Vance has brought some hurt to the Trump campaign. The cat lady's remark is now institutionalized, and it hurts. That is, that's a not something that it just reinforces Democratic messages about Trump and his treatment of women and his view of women. And that kind of remark reinforces that those messages that are coming from the Democrats. So, you don't see it very often, but I don't believe Sarah Palin helped McCain. And, we have a few examples, not many, but a few examples in history where the vice president matters, not because they really boost or hurt or win a state. Sometimes that might happen, but more importantly, when they become a drag.
And Ron, I see you agreeing with Gene that a vice presidential candidate can hurt. So does that mean you don't really think a Tim Walz, who is, from a rural area versus the urban area that Kamala Harris is from, and as a white man and a football coach and a veteran, you don't think that really helps?
Right now, Governor Walz is adding to the momentum and the energy for Democrats at the convention, and that matters in terms of morale. But yeah, long term, I completely agree with Jean. I have a friend from my grad school days, Jonathan Bernstein, who writes on parties, and his motto on this issue is that the only real rule for vice presidents is do no harm, because vice presidential candidates can do a lot more damage, really, at the end of the day than they can help. And so far, Governor Walz has not done any damage, I think, to that ticket.
All right. Well, we will be back in just a minute. We'll go to Asher and Sacco after our break. If you have a question, give us a call at 1-800-399-3566 or send a brief email, talk@mainepublic.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we are talking about the race for the White House. My guest, Ron Schmidt, department head and professor of political science at USM, and former Wall Street Journal Washington Bureau Deputy Chief Gene Cummings. Join the conversation. Send an email, talk@mainepublic.org. Comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. As promised, going to Asher from Saco. Hi, Asher. Go ahead.
Hi there. Thank you for having me. I'm curious what y'all thought of Biden's reference to the protesters outside during the convention, and if we might expect a stronger statement from Harris calling for a ceasefire.
Jean.
Well, obviously, this is a very, very tricky subject for them. And they've been a bit lucky that the protesters have not stolen the spotlight from the stage itself. I thought that the speakers last night, the American couple whose son is a hostage, I thought they put things beautifully and in a very moving way when they talked about how, there's enough pain to go around in the Middle East right now, and it's on all sides. And I felt that was a very gracious, moving way to talk about the issue. And so, that Harris is going to have to deal with it, and rightly so. There's been some reporting that she is not as loyal or aligned with Netanyahu than Biden. Biden and Netanyahu go back decades. She doesn't. So we'll see if there's some nuance in between what he says and what she says tonight. But again, I thought the person who role modeled, the people who role modeled how to talk about it, were those poor parents.
Ron, anything to add to that?
We've seen a fair amount on issues of women's reproductive choice too, of a choice of speakers at this convention who touch on genuinely painful topics in a way that I think is moving and tasteful. So that I agree with Jean about that moment from last night. The act of protesting the streets can sometimes be depicted as not legitimate activity, as a form of crime. That I'm sure that the Trump campaign is ready to depict anything like that as an example of the Democrats not really having control of cities or of the danger of too much discord. And they've been, I agree, they have been fortunate so far that hasn't happened. We've seen some signs of sort of official respect, I think, from speakers about the fact of protest. Those issues are still there very much, and this is still an issue, I think, of real tension within the party. But to the degree that that can keep from spilling over this week, that works, I'm sure, to the vice president's benefit.
Thank you, Asher, for your question. And Ron, Asher is looking forward to hearing from presidential nominee Kamala Harris tonight in terms of what she's going to say about the Middle East. What are you looking for her to say, and what will you be looking for with your political scientist eye? What does Kamala Harris need to accomplish tonight?
What impressed me in 2020 from Joe Biden was his ability to hold together a party that's notoriously fractious, just because it's a sign of something that can be a strength otherwise. There's a lot of different groups that make up the Democratic Party, and they have very genuine arguments about which direction the party should go. And he did a good job of maintaining a peace there in the last election. So far, the Harris team seems to be accomplishing the same thing. I've seen a level of organization within the Democratic Party that I haven't seen before, in the time I've been paying attention to politics.
So you're looking for a unifying message.
I am, and I think she's probably going to manage that. So, for me, the question already is now becoming where we go next.
And
Well,
Jean, what are you looking for tonight? What do you think that Kamala Harris has to accomplish?
I think it's a pretty high bar. I think she has a lot of work that she's got to do. She has to introduce herself because even though she's been on the political stage for a while, people don't know the vice president the same way they know the president. And she wants a promotion. So she's got to introduce herself. She's got to make her own case. And I do think she's got to put some meat on the bones. We've got sound bites from commercials and her stump speech. I don't think it's good enough, though. I think, as Ron said, she's got to lay out the direction She wants to take the country under her leadership. And I don't think she's made that case yet. Now, she's only been the nominee for a month, so everybody cut her some slack on that front. But tonight's the night where she's got to start laying that foundation. And I do think it's a very high bar.
It's interesting you say this, Jean, because I wanted to ask you about that. Whether or not, I know a lot of journalists want to see more specific policy proposals from her, and but then there are others who are saying, you know, let's not go down this road. Let's just make her make this race about character and about personality and not about specific issues. And I'm wondering, when it comes down to it in November, what do voters vote on? Do they vote on policy proposals and issues, or do they vote on their gut feeling about a person?
I personally believe most people vote with their gut, but I do think there are others that, particularly in the case of President Trump, they liked what policies he laid out. And they weren't really wild about him, but they voted for him anyway because they wanted their taxes to go down or they wanted the border shut down. So it can be a combination. If we're going to speak generally, I think people go with their gut or their partisan alliance. But like I said, I think she's got to put some meat on the bone. She's got to explain what her leadership would mean to every American voter, and what kind of policies would she present, and how would it affect them? Maybe not a laundry list. That was Bill Clinton's claim to fame, but some of it. We got to start having that conversation with her.
We'll go to Mark, who's calling from Vienna. Hi, Mark, go ahead.
Thanks, Jennifer. I'm wondering what can we learn about presidential climate crisis policies from the past Democratic and Republican approaches to COVID and immigration? Are they likely to use science and facts versus disinformation, identify crises versus nicknaming them? Focus on future generations versus the short term and relate among neighbors as opposed to opponents.
Ron?
Thank you for that question, Mark. That's a great question. I think the Harris campaign is going to be trying to make the case that this is the moment to focus on the future, but we do have to look at the past to get a sense of the answer to that question. The Trump administration didn't seem to take the climate crisis very seriously. And we have to take that into account, and I think voters will in what they expect to see in the future from a potential second Trump administration. The Biden administration emphasized alliances and treaties and relationships with other governments as a way to deal with this, and more support for the EPA. And we'll need to see if the candidate Harris wants to emphasize that linkage and that connection and sort of that promise of how they'll deal with it.
Jean, anything you'd like to add?
Let me just say that given that I believe the Harris campaign really wants to be about the future, in their reach to young voters, I think climate change is a big deal. And, you know, they've gotten the young people excited again. And I think by talking about tackling climate change, she has an opportunity to get them even more excited about her candidacy.
Mark, thanks for your call. An email here from Deb. I don't understand how some people have not made up their minds. Question: what does that mean? The candidates are such polar opposites. I don't get it. Gina, what would you say to Deb?
Well, I think that one thing people struggle with is if they have a partisan alignment that they're comfortable with and they've had for a while that in their gut is being challenged, that makes them undecided. Should they go home or should they take the leap and vote for the other side and see what happens? I think that drives a lot of people into the undecided column. There are also a lot of people who simply don't get focused on the election until very late in the process. They have busy lives. They're on vacation. It's August. How many of them are sitting up there in Maine having coffee with all of you all? They have busy lives, and so they don't focus until the very end. So that leaves them in an undecided category. That's another reason you could get someone could say, I just don't know yet.
Ron, you're nodding. You agree?
Oh yeah. I mean the analogy I use with first year students is like sports. You know, the vast majority of people have some sort of vague connection to one team or another, but you don't really pay attention until fairly late in the season when you have a sense of how things are going to come out. And in politics, a lot of people have generally some kind of alliance with one party or another, even if they're independents, but they don't pay terribly close attention and they don't draw links between politics and their day-to-day lives. Which I think reflects to some degree a failure of education, honestly. But lots of people are still not watching. Now, with the conventions and with the end of summer, we're going to begin to see that level of focus.
Okay. Let's see. We will go to Holly, who's calling from Charleston. Hi, Holly. Go ahead.
Hi there. You asked about the issues that are most important to us. So I think that for me and for many, 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 many people, the genocide, war, battle, slaughter, whatever word you choose to use, we are paying for it. We are building the weapons, taking the weapons, and giving them the money to buy the weapons from us, which any congressperson or representative who owns stock in any military-industrial complex company is making money from.
Holly, this is interesting that you've brought this up because you are in the second district, I believe, in Charleston. What does this mean to you? And both of your candidates seem to not be agreeing with you.
I don't know. I'm talking about the presidential election right now, so I thought I would speak to what Deb said. Many of us feel, and I'm 100% not ever voting for Trump, and I despise the man. So just to make that clear, nonetheless, many of us feel like, either way, there's genocide. Either way, homelessness is out of control, and half of the people we know are really hoping that we don't wind up homeless in our old age. They need a $50 billion, $50 billion, which is much, much less than we've given to kill people and destroy a country, for housing. They need that. It's out of control, and we're decades away from housing being under control, and they need to say, we're going to do it. We're going to do it now. Every state's getting a billion. Of course, that will serve us better in Maine than California.
Holly, thank you so much. You hear these issues that are important to Holly, what's going on in the Middle East and housing, the homelessness crisis. Does Holly speak for a majority or a large number of voters? Ron, I'll turn to you first.
I mean, in terms of polling data, I don't know, but I thank Holly too for addressing these things. Because these are incredibly important issues. A lot of voters seem to be aware of a number of issues that are globally important without really making them an issue in how they vote. And for people who feel like Holly, like neither party is really addressing their concerns, that can be incredibly frustrating and raise questions about the process. I think that insisting on raising these issues is crucial. And keeping an eye on what the campaigns have to say about them is crucial. The Harris campaign at this point hasn't said much that's particularly substantive about what's going on in the Middle East, except for a call for a ceasefire and to bring hostages home. What kind of a path that they're talking about for that, we can try to get a sense of from the Biden administration and similarly from the Trump administration's previous attitudes on these matters. But I hear that level of frustration. It's a slow grind, and it's difficult to redirect the U.S. government when we are providing material support that, among many other things, also leads to such a scale of death and destruction.
And Gene, I want to talk a little bit about the homelessness issue, because I think that the Middle East war, even if not very in-depth, has been addressed during the convention. But Not as much talking about the housing crisis, though it is one of the few platform issues Kamala Harris has talked about.
Yes, she's talked a little bit about helping people to buy a home, but I think that the caller's talking more about real homeless.
Yeah.
Well, I have not read anything that she or anybody in her camp might have said about that. And partly that, to me, could be that that's not really been viewed as much as a federal issue as a state issue. And I mean, the feds can help, as the caller said. You know, you can fund things, you can get money to states to deal with the issue. But I think what we are seeing in some cases, and California stands out to me, are very aggressive efforts to deal with it. And there will be lessons learned. Houston as well has been very aggressive. And in Houston, they do it very differently. You know, California is doing it through its government. Houston is doing some of it with working coalitions with churches and things like that. So there are some cities that are getting serious about homelessness, and they can create models for other cities to deal with it as well. But I agree with the caller. It's not been a big federal issue because really there's not much, there's historically not really been a federal role.
I talked before about how the Democratic Party is trying to model itself as pro-democracy at this particular moment. And it's been a long time since we had a Democratic administration that insisted on some basic level of economic subsistence as a key part of a healthy democracy. And I think this provides an opportunity for that to happen, but I don't know.
We are talking about the race for the presidency. If you have a question or if you have a comment, give us a call, 1-800-399-3566, or send a brief email, talk@mainpublic.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we are discussing the 2024 election. Joining me, Gene Cummings, former Washington Bureau Deputy Chief at the Wall Street Journal, longtime politics reporter. Also, USM Political Science Professor Ron Schmidt. Share your comments or questions. If you're quick, you can send a quick email, talk@mainpublic.org. You can also post on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. An email from Carl: should Kamala Harris win the election and Trump once again falsely claim he won the election, should Biden implement the Insurrection Act to activate the National Guard to protect the Capitol before certification and arrest Trump? And Carl adds, put Trump on trial for insurrection. I think a lot of people, Gene, are wondering what might happen on Election Day or in the time between Election Day and inauguration. And I'm wondering, I understand that both parties have an army of lawyers working on this. And I'm wondering what you're hearing from your sources. What are the fears and what are founded and what are sort of, you know, crazy talk?
Well, it's hard to tell at this point because, you know, both sides are saying they're going to win. So nobody's planning for a defeat, except, as you say, in the hiring of lawyers. And we've always seen this. There's always a battery of lawyers who are put on alert, go to polling places, monitor events, stand by the ready to file instant claims in court if necessary. The Democrats do it particularly to protect minority voters and voting areas. The Trump people will do it, you know, where they think there might be fraud. But that being said, there are a lot of lawyers who work for Trump who now are out of work, who now have lost their law licenses. So I think that that should be warning for many of the lawyers who are being assembled for this particular election. You can't just get away with, you know, winging it and making stuff up. The courts and the judges have made it utterly clear, Rudy Giuliani being, you know, suspect number one. So there are consequences if they take huge legal risks. I think Biden will be vigilant, yes, but I don't know, but let's hope Trump came away with some lessons learned. He's already going to trial in D.C. for what happened on January 6th. They've got to sort out which charges pass Supreme Court muster, given the recent court ruling. But that case didn't go away. So he's already looking at a trial for January 6th. Does he want another one? I sure hope not.
Ron?
Yeah, the Biden administration has to be aware of the potential for danger, because this happened last time, and the not just the Trump campaign, but the GOP generally refuses to classify that as an insurrection, or even really as a problematic event. So they have to be prepared for the possibility of some level of violence. And I think that's why we're seeing Democrats at the convention pushing really hard for the idea that they want a really big win to make it harder for a Trump campaign to make the argument of a steal. I don't know. I'm braced for it, I guess.
We'll go to Bob, who's calling from Blue Hill. Hi, Bob. Go ahead.
Yeah, just in full disclosure, I'm voting for Harris because, you know, I think she's dynamic and humanitarian person, and also it'd be great to have a woman president. But I'm concerned about Kennedy. You know, there's talk recently that he may throw his support towards Trump, and at one point he was polling as much as 15%. I think it's maybe 3 to 5 now, but I just wonder what your guests think about that.
Yeah, thanks, Bob. And Ron, really interesting question, especially with that last name.
It is. I think he has you know, wasted some of the potential that name brought him initially to be more of a spoiler. You know, there were comparisons at one point to Ross Perot, who was a really important figure in the outcome in 1992. And I think RFK Jr. has sort of let that moment go. But this is, especially with this level of partisanship and a race this close, this does have the potential to be decisive.
Yeah. Jean, do you think that RFK's endorsement, if it does come, of Trump, could make a big difference?
Well, they certainly seem to think so. All the reporting is that it's Don Jr. who's been trying to broker this deal. So that's how important the Trump camp sees and the threat that they see, that RFK would pull votes not from Kamala Harris, but from Trump. And so they're trying to patch this together and make sure that there isn't an alternative for their own voters. So they think it matters. Overall, you know, as Ron said, if it's a really close election, everything matters.
Yeah, Bob, thanks for your question. An email here from Jane. Should the Democrats make more of an issue that J.D. Vance is one heartbeat away from becoming president, given Trump's advanced age and at times questionable health and mental status, especially facing a 4-year term? Does it even matter to voters? So we'll get back to the vice president question, Jean. Because of Trump's age, is it a bigger question, or do people not think that deeply?
Most people don't. Most people think, you know, they have great medical care at the White House, and it's true, they do. And that, you know, Trump would go ahead and live through the 4 years. What I find more interesting with Vance, and I love this question, because as you all could probably tell now, I've given some thought to this vice presidential situation. But what strikes me about Vance is that he just hasn't been a politician for very long. And, you know, he ran for the Senate, and that's pretty much it. And I have long felt that one of the reasons Kamala Harris had a a bumpy start as vice president is because she was not a real lifetime politician in the way that in DC we know them. She was a lawyer. And so when it came to tough questions, it wasn't easy for her to bluff answers or not answer, because that's not how a lawyer is trained. And, you know, people who've been in the House and Senate forever, they've got the art of dodging a question down to an absolute science. They're really, really good at it. But, you know, with Vance, we'll see how he performs, but he's on a mighty tall stage for someone with as little experience as he has.
All right. We're going to go to Kitsy calling from Portland. Hi, Kitsy. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm voting for Kamala, no doubt. And 5 years ago, I bought a pendant that said, throughout it all, the lotus flower blooms. And I don't know how many people know that Kamala translates to lotus, as in the lotus flower. And so, and then my daughter said, well, why don't we say POTUS lotus? And I thought, great. I also wanted to see the VP possibility. One of the things he said that I just loved is, we need to work now. You can sleep when you're dead. So that's been a mantra for me. You can sleep when you're dead. And a Republican last night, I've been watching every single moment of this convention, a Republican said, you know, if you're a Republican, voting for Kamala does not make you a Democrat. It makes you a patriot. So I am just so excited. And I beg to differ. She's been very specific about some things. She said, for example, that she would find a way to loan $25,000 to qualified people to purchase their first new home. I mean, she's been quite, and how she would go about taking care of the gouging of the food, not supermarket individuals, but supermarket chains. And she's had some specific ideas. So I'm just thinking she is great. So throughout it all.
Thank you. Thank you, Kitsy. Thanks for calling in and joining us. You know, I want to bring up something we haven't brought up yet, which is, you know, the fact that Kamala Harris is a woman. And I'm of an age where there is a feeling in my gut that America will not elect a woman president. And Jean, I think you're my age, maybe even a little bit older. How do you think about this?
Yes, I think that the Democrats and everyone should not overlook the fact that there is a lot of misogyny and a lot of racism still in America. She's got both that she's got to overcome. I have long thought that if you look at Governor Hochul's race in New York, the Cuomos would walk away with the governorship, hands down, win it by double-digit margins, not Hochul. It was single digits. What's the difference? The policies are all the same. So what's the difference? It's putting a woman in the governor's office. I think women still face a lot of challenges. I think it's changing. You could tell by the demographics of the speakers on the stage. They're in Chicago. But I agree with the call with you, and that we have to be vigilant and skeptical.
What about you, Ron? What do you think?
No, I agree. The level of to which misogyny affects both political decision making and political rhetoric couldn't be clearer at this point. It's right on the table with issues, for example, again of reproductive freedom and of the ability to make healthcare decisions. And in regard to race, when President Obama ran, he got support from a percentage of Americans who seemed to think that having a Black president would sort of magically quell issues of race as a problem within American society. And when that didn't happen, that seemed to engender a certain amount of cynicism. A candidate, Harris, I don't think is gonna be able to draw on that faith that this will somehow magically resolve these issues. So that's a very difficult job for her to do.
Well, that's going to be our last word. Thank you both for such an interesting conversation. Ron Schmidt, the department head and professor of political science at the University of Southern Maine. Gene Cummings, a longtime political reporter and former deputy chief of the Washington Bureau at the Wall Street Journal. Today's sound engineer was Sam Tracy, Maine Calling produced by Cindy Hahn and Jonathan Smith. You can visit the Maine Calling website to sign up for our weekly newsletter or listen to past programs. Tomorrow on the program, we are going to listen back to our earlier show about really paying attention to nature. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you have been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.